Today on Studio 360, we take on a makeover of a certain North American country consisting of 10 provinces and 3 territories encompassing 9.9 million square kilometers, whose border with the United States is the longest in the world.
It's not what you think of us, Kurt. It's that you don't think of us.
You know, Canada. We kick off our Canada rebranding project with design experts, Canadians, and you. And we'll talk about a book. The book. You know the one I mean.
Well, I didn't know that it was perverted and weird and sex trash when I picked it up. All I heard was number one on the bestseller list.
Why 50 Shades of Grey has gotten the publishing industry all hot and bothered. That and more ahead in Studio 360 right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We've redesigned Christmas and the image of teachers and the gay pride flag. But now we're taking on our biggest makeover challenge ever, Canada.
You know something about hockey and beer, which is actually correct. Those are two of our national pastimes. But there's also this notion that we're twee and nice, and there's a lack of appreciation for our cultural diversity and vibrance. This redesign thing is going to have to be impressive.
I wish Americans realized that 20% of the foreign oil comes from Canada.
There's the same percentage of Canadians that say A as Americans who say y'all.
Rebranding Canada later this hour, but to start the show...
Un, deux, trois, quatre.
As the fifth season of Mad Men finishes up on Sunday, that odd poppy French tune from the first episode will probably be stuck in our heads forever.
Zooby, zooby, zoo.
For a show that's always been about the way the 1960s look to us here in the 2010s, that scene established the show's new style icon, Megan, Don Draper's new wife. Maybe you're a Mad Men fan or even a full-bore Mad Men geek, but I very much doubt you're as obsessively devoted as the blogger Tom Fitzgerald. Every week in Slate magazine, he deconstructs in knowing detail the characters' clothes and what they mean. How the costumes reveal subtexts in the scripts and reflect the tensions and upheaval of 1960s America. That's a lot, Tom. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think you pretty much covered all my work.
Well, there you go. So are you...
All right, let's call it a day.
Are you excited about the finale this weekend?
Yeah, I'm very excited, especially since we've now reached 1967, and this is the point in the 60s where fashion really exploded outside of the counterculture movement and started infecting, shall we say, the more establishment characters. So,
right. Well, and of course, it started in the early 60s. Did you, from the beginning, love the show qua show, the characters and the stories, or was it the clothes and the 60s interior design and the objects and the smoking and drinking, all that style stuff captured you?
It was a little bit of both. My partner Lorenzo and I, we have always been huge fans of mid-century style, both in decor and in clothing. And on our own blog, TomandLorenzo.com, we started doing top 10 lists between seasons of, you know, top 10 Betty Draper looks and top 10 Joan Holloway looks. Once you spend just a little bit of time examining these clothes, you realize just how intricately planned out these things are and how much is being said in the clothing. On a personal note, my mother in 1960 was a good Catholic girl from an outer borough who was working in Manhattan, and her name was Peggy.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So, Peggy's son.
Yeah.
It is this celebration of, as you say, mid-centuries decor and style. Is it as lovingly obsessed on the way things look and the way people are dressed, or is that something we bring to it?
No, I think in terms of accuracy, it's amazingly accurate. The costume designer, Janie Bryant, doesn't just look at fashion magazines of the period or, say, sitcoms of the period to see how people dress, because that is not how people dress.
Right.
She looked at things like clothing catalogs and actual vintage photographs from people's families and stuff like that. You know, when the show first starts out, the point is being made in the clothing in the early seasons of the show that these characters are still living in the 1950s and very unprepared for the 60s. That's why, say, Betty works a very Grace Kelly look, and Joan used to work a very Marilyn Monroe look, because these were iconic 1950s women. And what's interesting is now that we're getting into the mid to late 60s, you're seeing how some of these characters are not changing. Don is going to end the 60s in a skinny tie.
It's true.
And a skinny lapel jacket. He's not going to grow sideburns or start wearing Nehru jackets.
Well, he hasn't changed at all, has he, in the way he dresses?
No, he has not changed at all. And I checked the width of his lapels, the width of his tie, it has not changed in the last 6, 7 years now.
You really seem to be saying that as the plot has its twists and turns, the clothes are trying to signal and reflect that.
Yes. Janie Bryant signals a lot of different things with the clothing that's not necessarily in the script. She signals class distinctions. She signals how people are tied to their surroundings. One of the things she does quite often, she did this with Betty when she was Mrs. Draper. Her clothes always matched the room she was standing in. Her clothes always matched either the living room or the kitchen or the dining room. And that was a subtle way of tying her to that home, almost literally, that she was trapped in that home and she couldn't get out of it. Certain themes will appear over and over again. For instance, Peggy's power color is a golden yellow. Whenever she wears that in the office, it usually signals that she either something good is happening in her career or she's just working very, very hard. So a lot of the scenes this season where you saw her working late at night, she was in a golden yellow sweater or a golden yellow skirt.
I need you to sign off on Secret Laxative.
I told you you were in charge of all ongoing business till Jaguar's done. Just handle it.
Done. How's the prospect doing? Is it lunchtime?
Jesus, is it?
Mr. Sterling bought lobster from the pond. Doesn't that sound good?
Do you think the makers of Mad Men are doing this in a very conscious way, like giving the young Peggy gold clothes to wear when she's, locking and loading and succeeding?
Well, I mean, that's the eternal question. It's what was deliberate and what are we as the audience taking away from it? Joan wears a lot of purple, and we noted that when she wears, quite often when she wore purple, it was dealing with romantic heartache in her life. Breaking up with Roger, the first time you found out that she was Roger's mistress, when she found out that Roger remarried, she was also, when she got raped, she was in a purple dress.
Huh.
That was so consistent that I thought purple, for whatever reason, signifies Joan's heart. And then in this season, we noted that roses signified her marriage and that she was wearing roses whenever she was in a scene with her husband. And in over time, the roses on her clothes were getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And then the scene after she throws him out of the house, she's lying in bed with her mother and her baby, and she's wearing a little blouse with tiny, tiny, tiny little roses on them as if the whole thing had diminished completely.
Well, this season is ending at the beginning of 1967. So with the next season, we will see the full bore 60s.
Yeah, hitting. That should be fun.
Well, it should be fun. And it seems to me it's where they could really go wrong. Do you think they're smart enough to do it right?
I have faith in them. In what little bits of the counterculture that have been coming in bit by bit, I think she's been very restrained. You will see the hippie styles, but they'll be in the background, or someone will float through, or there will be some character who will stop by. I mean, they managed to work beatniks in for the first 3 seasons. So like much of the cultural change that is talked about on this show, it happens in the margins or in the pauses in between conversations. It's not the main focus.
Well, I was glad to discover you doing this, because I've always maintained that one can't overstate the degree to which this show is about the way the people look and things look and offices look. And,
right.
And now you are its scholar.
Thank you.
Do you know what you'll be wearing as you watch the last show of the season on Sunday?
Well, I always wear my pajamas. I'm not going to be all dressed up. I'm not the type that has cocktail parties while I'm watching Mad Men. I have to get a recap up by 9 a.m. the next morning. So it's usually work for me.
Tom Fitzgerald, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Tom Fitzgerald writes the Mad Style blog on TomandLorenzo.com and Slate. So what do you all think? Is Mad Men mainly about the production design and costumes, or is it a lot more? Let us know at studio360.org. Sellers and publishers of books from all over the country and the world convened in New York City this week for their big annual convention, Book Expo America. Of course, people were talking about ebooks, social media, self-publishing, and this strange old-fashioned phenomenon, a printed and bound blockbuster that appeared from out of nowhere.
50 Shades of Grey. Isn't that that sex book?
What? No, go outside.
Look, a microphone. Mommy!
That Saturday Night Live sketch isn't nearly as dirty as the actual book, which is the story of a young woman and the man she likes to ravish her. The author E.L. James first published 50 Shades of Grey as fan fiction based on the Twilight series. All the vampire bits were deleted, and the super high-end Knopf Vintage imprint published the book a few months ago, and voila, the 50 Shades trilogy occupies all the top spots on the New York Times bestseller list. We sent a reporter over to Book Expo America to find out how the book world's reacting.
If you go around to all the booths, everyone has their erotica books featured now. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, most publishers now have an erotic fiction line and are hoping to somehow discover what it is, the magic.
We're buying a lot more erotica now, yes. And we're seeing that customers are buying it as well. She's made it, you know, erotic fiction socially acceptable.
We have a BDSM novel just about to come out, which is what 50 Shades of Grey is, you know, bondage, sadomasochism.
We're reissuing and repackaging three of Anne Rice's old novels that she wrote, I think, in like 1983. They're supposed to be pretty crazy erotica.
As an agent, I've received at least six proposals by clients and non-clients about doing a 50 Shades of Grey type book. I think the challenge of doing these types of books is to get them out first. Within the next season or two, we'll see all the books that are derivative of the mothership, so to speak.
The old days, the tried and true way of going through the agent, going through the whole process with every single publisher still exists, obviously, but now there are ways for people to get their books published. At St. Martin's Press, we have published a couple of authors who started with just online chapters.
What we've seen is once the print books actually hit the market, that both the print books and the digital books have been creating demand for each other.
It's made ebooks for mommy porn a lot more of a viable option because mommies can read it whenever and nobody knows what they're reading. So you don't have the cover of the book that shows a bodice ripper that's really embarrassing to read. You can read it and nobody knows what you're reading, and then you go home and have a good time with your husband.
Book people at the BEA in New York City this week. They spoke with reporter Eric Malinsky. There's something kind of quaint and cute about a dirty piece of pop culture that millions of regular Americans are suddenly chattering about. Reminds me of when I was a little kid and the earnest Swedish porn movie I Am Curious Yellow became the national conversation object. Also old-fashioned are some of the awkward conversations around 50 Shades of Grey. Reporter Rebecca Lee Douglas wanted to find out who's been buying the book and discovered a bit more than she bargained for. And if you haven't presumed as much, this next piece will involve some explicit sexual content.
Like the sign says, the Strand Bookstore in downtown Manhattan has 18 miles of new, used, and rare books, so it can be hard to pick a title from that crowd. But the 50 Shades trilogy is not hard to find. It's right in the center of the bestsellers table. Saves customers the trouble of asking for it, though some still do.
They fall into two categories. One is the complete gleeful, like, ownership of it, like, where's the dirty book? I want the dirty book.
This is Liz Devoten, a manager at The Strand.
The second category of people is maybe this is their first time buying erotica, and it's from a store. So there's a little bit more, I guess, maybe coyness about it. Like, I don't know about this book. I sort of heard about it. 50 Shades of something. And it's, you know, it's sort of adorable. It's like, yes, you know, we have it right here. It's very popular.
Staffers at The Strand are excited about the book, not just because it's kinky or because it's selling a lot. Kate Garber works on the staff picks here. She says 50 Shades of Grey has created a silent but really useful conversation between the store and its customers.
Like, if someone knows that a staff member is recommending this book and saying, come on, it's okay if you think this is sexy, people will buy it and they love it.
They might very well buy it, love it, and then head down to Soho to Babeland, a woman-owned sex toy shop. Sales have been going up at Babeland since 50 Shades of Grey hit the bestseller list. Conversations about the erotic are a lot more frank here, of course.
We have a big metal rack that has all of our restraints, blindfolds, floggers, paddles, and other assorted sensation toys.
Babeland co-founder Claire Cavanaugh is showing me the BDSM section. That stands for bondage, discipline, and sadomasochism. Cavanaugh says they can't keep BDSM stuff on the shelves now.
It's looking a little sparse, I'm telling you, because so many people are buying things, you know, so quickly, it's hard to keep things in stock.
The store has started workshops on how to use the implements described in 50 Shades, and the classes are so popular they've filled up over a month in advance.
And this you would definitely find in the dungeon in that book. These are floggers. This is a leather, it's a very long one. It's like soft leather on the inside.
Cavanaugh suede, goes on showing me Babeland's toys, sometimes using words like sex positive. It feels like college here. But I'd heard that the main customers driving the sales of 50 Shades are middle-aged women. I needed to find someone older I could talk to about this book. But how?
Hello, Nancy speaking.
Hi, Mom. This is your daughter, Rebecca.
Oh, hi, Rebecca.
I am calling because the other day I talked to you about people who you knew were reading 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, yeah, the sex trash book, right.
Yes. Let me pause here to say that I had no idea that my mom had read this book. My mom, who's 53 and usually reads historical fiction. What you're about to hear is the most uncomfortable conversation I have ever had with her.
Well, I didn't know that it was perverted and weird and sex trash when I picked it up. I mean, all I heard was number one on the bestseller list. So I picked it up. And then, you know, within like the second chapter, you just see the kinky weirdness of it.
It's actually the seventh chapter, but that's when protagonist Christian Grey brings young Anastasia to his red room of pain to show her all of his devices for flagellating and penetrating. Did you tell Dad about the book?
No! No, I hope he doesn't know it.
Did you enjoy reading it? Was it, like, a fun read for you?
Well, it was kind of interesting. I did learn a lot of things I didn't know.
Yeah, like, what did you learn?
I mean, there were all sorts of, you know, devices and things I knew nothing about before, so.
Okay, what are the devices that you know about now?
Oh, my gosh. Well, like the butt plugs. I mean, these things I had no idea were out there. I think I'll avoid, but.
Yeah, we kept discussing the book, but I was dying inside. Interviewing total strangers at bookstores and sex toy shops is fine, but my mom and I have barely ever talked about sex. I thought it was because she was the prude. Okay. All right. Thanks, Mom.
Okay, honey. Love you. Bye.
For Studio 360, I'm Rebecca Lee Douglas.
Is there any cultural sex trash you indulged in that you ended up loving? A smutty novel or dirty movie that you thought, hey, this is pretty good? Tell us about it at studio360.org. Coming up, surely you've heard of the Bone Wars.
They were two great paleontologists called Othniel Marsh and Edwin Drinker Cope. And they had a great rivalry, but they were really nasty. And if one of them worked on a dinosaur site and got everything he wanted, he would blow up the site with dynamite for fear that his rival might come and find something there. This is a scientific sin to blow up a fossil site, but that's how nasty these individuals were.
The birth of the dinosaur industrial complex. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we now present a special bilateral announcement.
Kurt Anderson, you're at Studio 360 in New York City. I'm Gian Gameschi of Q here in Toronto. So we're together to announce the launch of a cross-border co-production brotherhood situation.
Brotherhood situation with like brothers. There can be some kicking in the shins as well, perhaps. But yes, we are, because, you know, we are neighbors, after all. I spent many, many summers visiting my neighbors to the north in Canada, and I presume you guys sometimes come south to us, and we're neighbors, so we see each other around, and sometimes neighbors, which I'm spelling without the Canadian U, have thoughts about that family next door. Why does their 28-year-old daughter still live at home? Does the husband ever wear anything but that tracksuit?
Exactly, Kurt. That so we came up with this neighborly idea. We're calling it the Redesign Project. So what would Canada and the U.S. look like if we gave each other a kind of cultural makeover, right?
Exactly. We had the idea of this extreme makeover, a sort of sovereign nations edition. So all during June, Studio 360 is going to be with experts, with our own evil plans and regular people redesigning and rebranding Canada.
Evil plans?
Well, not evil. Not evil.
Right, right. We've heard this about you. And in turn, in Canada, Q, summoning up our powers, our superpowers, we intend to rebrand America.
We've never taken on a whole country before. So even a small country, you're still a real country in our view. So
Thank you. We're off to a good start.
There you go.
You'll accept us as a real country.
You got, what, 30, 35 right. million people?
Yeah.
So to get a feel for what our fellow U.S. citizens are already thinking about Canada, we talked to some New Yorkers on the street to sort of gauge the knowledge level and sentiment.
Do you know the capital of Canada?
No. Unfortunately, I don't.
Toronto? No.
Is it Montreal or Quebec? One of those.
Alberta?
It's something with a T, right?
Quebec is the capital.
Is there a national capital?
Toronto? I'm sorry, Ottawa. Ottawa.
Ottawa?
Ottawa? Am I right?
Who's your favorite Canadian?
Is Wayne Gretzky Canadian?
I don't know any Canadians at all.
Michael Bublé.
I keep forgetting her name. She's a favorite.
Shania Twain.
Joni Mitchell.
Samantha Bee. Alec Trebek.
How not?
Well, a few of them knew Ottawa. Poor Ottawa.
I love the guy who says, is there a national capital?
That was my favorite. Right. See, that's what I'm saying. That's the
basic. Now that they've achieved statehood, they're an actual country, have they decided on a capital yet? This Canada you speak of.
Exactly. It's so postmodern, the idea that a country wouldn't have a capital, right?
Oh, my. And then the Gretzky, I mean, we love Gretzky, but it's like an 80s reference, you know, in terms of a way to identify our country, right?
But that's the nature of brand identities. They take a long time to change, and that's why we're trying to give it a jolt.
See, there's a lot of things that are wrong with the way Americans see Canada. Not all Americans, because obviously there's a lot of Americans who listen to Q, and we'd like to think that they know more about Canada. But it's not what you think of us, Kurt. It's that you don't think of us. Yeah, Americans just don't think of, here we are, the biggest trading partner, the friends to the north, and we grow up in our schools learning all about the United States and history and culture,
right.
And we don't really feel like that's reciprocated. You know something about hockey and beer, which is actually correct. Those are two of our national pastimes. But there's also this notion that we're twee and nice, and there's a lack of appreciation for our cultural diversity and vibrance. So this redesign thing is going to have to be impressive.
Well, right now, in fact, we want to ask our listeners for a 6-word trial balloon slogan for how we should sell Canada to Americans and the world.
Okay. And we then, reciprocally, at Q, we're asking our audience for a 6-word sentence that sells America to the world. How would you reimagine, how would you rebrand, remake America, and give it to us in 6 words? What's your slogan? What's your saying? We want our Canadian listeners, and our American listeners for that matter, to help us help America.
And everyone from both countries can go to redesigningproject.com and participate.
redesigningproject.com. And I guess We're going to check back in with you on July 1st, which
Correct.
Is Canada Day.
As I'm told, that's Canada Day.
Yes, you didn't know we had a Canada Day?
I knew.
We have a capital, too, our nation's capital.
And I've been to Ottawa.
That's a good start. And I will speak to you on July 4th, Independence Day in the United States. We all know about that. With the winning slogan from our side, and maybe even a special cross-border quiz.
Oh, we could compete for knowledge of our respective nations.
I look forward to it.
Thank you, John.
Until then, Kurt, goodbye. Good luck.
Gian Gomeshi is the host of CBC's Q.
Times have changed. Our kids are getting worse. They won't obey their parents. They just want to fight and curse.
Should we blame the government or blame society?
Or should we blame the images on TV?
No, blame Canada.
Blame Canada.
It seems that everything's gone wrong since Canada came along.
Blame Canada. Blame Canada.
They're not even a real country anyway.
And you can keep suggesting your own slogans for rebranding Canada at redesigningcanada.com. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Most kids can tell you more about dinosaurs, creatures that disappeared 65 million years ago, than they can about the animals that live all around us today. Nobody's ever seen even a dead dinosaur, but why do we think we know exactly what they looked like? It's a long story, and reporter Sarah Lilly is going to tell us.
When I say the words Tyrannosaurus Rex, I know that your mind will instantly conjure the same image as mine. Which is weird, since no one, not you or I, nor even Stephen Jay Gould, has ever seen a living, teeth-gnashing, non-avian dinosaur. Not even in a photograph. That mental image we all share is really the legacy of just one man, a man whose tool was not a pickaxe or a well-appointed laboratory. It was a paintbrush.
Charles R. Knight was the greatest wildlife and paleo artist that ever lived. This is a very fascinating, passionate character that we're talking about.
Richard Milner is a historian of science whose new book is called Charles R. Knight, The Artist Who Saw Through Time. Knight was born in Brooklyn in 1874, and early in his childhood, he developed a passion for sketching every animal he could find. For a young boy, the timing was lucky. The late 19th century produced mind-blowing prehistoric discoveries in America. It was the beginning of the so-called Bone Wars. Come on, how cool does that sound?
People in the Old West were digging up dinosaurs for the first time and fighting over them. They were two great paleontologists called Othniel Marsh and Edwin Drinker Cope. They had a great rivalry, but they were really nasty. And if one of them worked on a dinosaur site and got everything he wanted, he would blow up the site with dynamite for fear that his rival might come and find something there. This is a scientific sin to blow up a fossil site. But that's how nasty these individuals were. They discovered thousands of species of dinosaurs and opened up the entire field and filled the American Museum of Natural History with its great dinosaur collection.
Back then, dinosaurs were being presented in museums as basically boxes of rocks. Bones and fossils stuck out of giant trays of prehistoric rubble, pretty much as they were found. Knight became an illustrator on staff at the museum, and he caught the attention of its president, Henry Fairfield Osborne.
Said, listen, your painting is great, but you're going to have to learn the science. You're going to have to learn the paleontology. You're going to have to be as good as anybody here in the museum when it comes to knowing what these creatures look like. And he said, I'm going to send you to my mentor, which was Edward Drinker Cope, the man in Philadelphia who had the great bone feud with Marsh of Yale.
Cope was down in Philadelphia, working out of his musty, bone-encrusted townhouse. Also, he was dying, so Knight went down there immediately.
And he found Cope to be the most fascinating conversationalist and thinker. Knight saw this fabulous room full of fossils, and he related to this amazing man who took him like a time machine into the past and let him see for the first time this wonderful vista of what was on Earth millions of years before any human could see it.
Knight spent 2 weeks there, poring over specimens and Cope's crude sketches. And when it was over, his brain was filled with pictures.
You have two animals, one on the ground, belly up, but clearly in a defensive posture, the other leaping upon it through the air, completely off the ground.
I've taken Milner's book on a visit to Paul Olson. He's a paleontologist at Columbia, and he grew up inspired by Knight's paintings. There's been a century of new discoveries in paleontology, including a return of the belief in feathers. But otherwise, Knight's depictions have held up surprisingly well, considering. We're looking at one right now.
It's a remarkable painting because it looks very much like aspects of our modern idea of what dinosaurs look like.
The backdrop is a lush hillside with detailed ferns and painterly grasses. But right up front is this battle between two dryptosaurs in tightly focused relief. They're like smaller T-Rexes, giant three-toed feet with talons, tiny front arms, thick tails whipping around, and gaping jaws of jagged teeth. You can practically smell their breath. Knight had done his homework.
Drawing animals, drawing bones, drawing your fossil is another way of translating what you're viewing into your mind. And often paleontologists who are also artists have a deeper connection with the fossils. I happen to be one of those kind of artists. If you look at these are drawings of mine.
Really?
Back there, some more.
Oh, look at that. That is so cool.
Drawing and art is, it's connected to anatomy. You can look down through history at artists who were involved with anatomy. Leonardo da Vinci, for one, right? And so this was, that's a very important connection. It really goes into your brain as a three-dimensional structure.
Over the next decade, Knight worked tirelessly to become the go-to guy for translating boxes of rocks into paintings that made the dinosaurs alive again. In addition to the museum in New York, his works hung in Chicago, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and people positively lapped it up.
In a very real sense, Charles R. Knight created our image of what a dinosaur looks like.
What was that? That's a Tyrannosaurus.
I don't think so.
The Brontosaur, the Stegosaur, the Triceratops, the millions of copies on them. Knight's dinosaurs escaped from the museum walls to become Hollywood stars. The first cartoon movie starred not a mouse, not a duck. It was Gertie the Dinosaur in 1917. Later, models were made using Knight's reconstructions in The Lost World in 1925, going through, of course, Conan Doyle himself, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, wrote the first dinosaur novel, and he swiped Knight's pictures. And Ray Harryhausen, many people know him as the great master of stop-motion animation. The purple singing dinosaurs on television, the kids' pajamas with dinosaurs all over them. I love
you. Well, Barney is an apparition. I'm sorry.
You can feel for Paul Olson on this one. But if Charles R. Knight is to blame for Barney, well, you just have to take the bad with the good.
When you can't see the animal alive in front of you, you have to have some kind of mental model of what it's like. And that is, in fact, what an artist does. And it's absolutely vital because once you communicate it, and in fact only once you communicate it, can the other scientists look at that discovery to make tests to see if it's really what it appears to be. If you don't communicate the information, it does not exist.
For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Lilly.
You can see some images of Charles Knight's paintings at studio360.org. Coming up, he's been all over the world, and he says the roughest travel experiences are the ones he wouldn't change.
You can't jet from capital to capital and get, you know, people giving you a kiss on both cheeks. You really need to be insulted at the border and get in a ramshackle bus or train and travel on, because that's how people really live.
Writer Paul Theroux is next. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Over the last 50 years, the writer Paul Theroux has traveled to most of the countries on Earth and traveled in a deep, slow, observant way most of us really never do. His novels are often about people more or less like him, people who rip themselves out of normal Western lives and go somewhere alien and maybe find out, for better or worse, who they really are. Like in his new novel, The Lower River. 62-year-old Ellis Hawk, a retailer in a Boston suburb, lights out for Malawi, where he'd worked as a Peace Corps volunteer as a young man many years before. Paul Theroux is here with me now. Paul, welcome back to Studio 360.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Kurt.
So you, like your protagonist in this novel, were a guy who grew up in Medford, Mass., and you also were a Peace Corps volunteer in Malawi when you were young and the Peace Corps was brand new. Ellis Hawk, that your main character, says that the years he spent in the Peace Corps were the best in his life. Do you have a sense that that's true of you as well?
Certainly they were among the best in my life. Ellis Hawk ended his Peace Corps career and then ran a clothing store in Medford. So you can understand why he might have thought the Peace Corps was great. Actually, the best years of your life, I think, probably are, you know, raising children or creating, writing, things like that. They go on being great, I think. But for Ellis, Africa was his Eden. He came alive there. He got away from home. He fell in love. He found people to like. And then he had to leave it. He's sort of expelled from it. So I identify with him, but I could say that the Peace Corps set me on a path into the world.
Has the Lower River been germinating ever since those days?
Very much so. When I was in Malawi, the Lower River area was called Port Herald. Port Herald was renamed Nsanje. But that area was the poorest, the most distant, the most malarial, very snaky, very. It was on the border of Portuguese East Mozambique, so it was not on the way to anywhere. And it was really the place that every Peace Corps volunteer sort of dreaded to be sent to. I was not a volunteer there. I went there, but I had friends who were there, so the place stayed in my mind as just a forgotten corner of the country. And then I had when I was in the Peace Corps, I had a definitive experience, too, which also stayed in my mind. One Christmas, I was with a group of people, and they said, come to our village and have a drink. It was late at night. So I went to the village, had a drink. Next morning, I woke up, and I said, that was great. Now I'm going to leave. They said, no, don't leave. Let's go get another drink. It was early in the morning. To make a very long story short, they wouldn't let me leave the village. And I thought, this is a kind of a nightmare. Of going to a place.
That's this book. Ellis Hawk, your character, becomes essentially imprisoned in this village.
I've written this as a story of trespassing and going to this version of a person goes on an invitation to a place, to a village, to a house, and then is not allowed to leave. To me, it's kind of a recurring theme or nightmare of mine.
For a person who spends so much of his life and work traveling, I guess that would be the ultimate nightmare.
Yes. And the idea of making a book, of writing a story about a man who is on the happiest trip of his life, the sentimental journey back to where he was the happiest, suddenly turns and keeps turning. And he's faced with one problem after another. We won't let you leave. But furthermore, it's not just they won't let him leave. They said, we're going to make you chief. You're going to be the chief. You're going to be head of it all. And here's your servant. Here's your house. And you're going to stay. This is your home, Father. This is your home. He says, no, it's not my home. Let me out of here. And suffers and then has to find a way out. So then it becomes, I guess, an adventure story, a problem that needs to be solved. And then I mean, turns into a parable of life itself, or of aid, of visit, of the other, of strangeness, of, you know, the place where you shouldn't be, that he's gone too far.
A lot of people, especially in the 60s and 70s when they were young, travel around the world cheaply and as you did. But then they stop when they turn 30 or 35. You, in your various ways, have kept on doing it. Do you do it because it's your job to write these marvelous books, nonfiction and fiction, about exotic places? Or do you need to do that and do it kind of roughly in some deeper way?
I used to think that I did it just for the compulsion to move, just to keep moving, to go. Stevenson has a line like that. Just the whole thing is just keep moving. D.H. Lawrence says that, you know, above all, just get out of the house, just keep moving.
Huck Finn, did that, for instance.
Yeah, it's lighting out for the territory. But I think the only worthwhile way of doing it is the old laborious way. You said something in your introduction about that. But I mean, the old laborious way of traveling overland on the road is the thing. That's the, if you're going to write about it, you can't jet from capital to capital and get, you know, people giving you a kiss on both cheeks. You really need to be insulted at the border and get in a ramshackle bus or train and travel on, because that's how people really live. How they're actually treated in a country is how they're treated in the hinterland. But you know, it's not necessary to suffer. So I'm getting too old for buses and, you know, disgusting meals.
When you're traveling to these places that most of us don't travel, in ways that most of us don't travel, do you still have sort of epiphanies? Do you still say, oh, that's a surprise, I never thought of it that way about this place or this kind of person or this village? Or have you seen it all, been there, done that too many times?
That's an interesting question. I had this feeling that when people when they're neglected, they develop in their own way. I noticed that when I'm in a village like that, when I was in southern Angola, just creeping along in my own hopeless way, I noticed that people... that two things happen. One is they keep their traditions. There's a thing called the Efundulis ceremony among the Kwanyama people, and it's basically just a, you know, coming of age ceremony. And I noticed I lucked into a place where they had the ceremony. It's just, you know, girls who are nubile. Nubile means marriageable, you know, in the technical sense. So it's a nubility ceremony. Now, that doesn't happen in the capital. It doesn't happen where, you know, where there's missionaries and so forth. This is a place that's completely left to itself. So a place left to itself becomes more itself, and people devise remedies for whatever problems they have. You know, they're homegrown remedies, and sometimes those work better than the ones imposed from the outside. So to answer your question, do I get to places and think, my goodness, I hadn't thought of that? Well, that was an epiphany that I had. I thought, you know, these people have been neglected and ignored and abandoned, but they found a way to keep their lives intact. And I liked that. And I was sort of impressed by it.
This is your 30-something novel. You've written, I don't know, a dozen, 15 more nonfiction books. How has your career worked out compared to what you'd imagined or hoped it would be, say, 30 years ago?
Yeah, more like 40, because I published my first book in 67. You know, when you start out writing, you choose a role model, there are many role models: Henry Miller, Graham Greene, you know, V.S. Naipaul. In my life, lots of mentors and lots of writer friends. And I just hoped that I could, you know, make a living, go on writing, and find a public, find people who liked reading my books. And I feel as if I've done that. I mean, I wasn't looking for success. I was looking for some kind of achievement. And someone who was like mine, people like me, people who travel, people who would like to travel but want to read about it. And I have no complaints. I really have no complaints.
And do you still get properly excited about the book you're working on? I'm just trying to get a sense of if you still are as robustly committed to this lucky job you have.
As a writer, it's groping in the dark. And I think getting up every morning to solve that problem, to face it, to develop it further, to, you know, have the character confront that destiny is really a very exciting thing. It's the thing that that animates me, and it's the thing I like doing best.
That's good to hear. Paul Theroux, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Paul Theroux's new novel, The Lower River, is out right now. For years, when she was young, Abigail Washburn was single-minded about meeting her goals. She wanted to be a lawyer, and she wanted to go to college.
The focus of my studies throughout college, and then those years after college, was to prepare to go study law in Beijing. When I graduated from college, the Colorado College, in 1999, I moved to Vermont, and I became a lobbyist. So in between these state legislature sessions, I would be either in Beijing acting as a intern at a consulting firm or going to school at the Middlebury College for Chinese.
But one night, she went to a party at a friend's house.
I think it might have been Bo, my boyfriend at the time, put on a record. I heard it out of the corner of my ear, and it was this beautiful, old-sounding voice and this incredibly rhythmic, vibrant, but rich and deep-sounding instrument. And it ended up that it was Doc Watson playing Shady Grove, and he was playing the banjo and singing.
Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, I say. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound to go away. Cheeks as red as a blooming rose, and eyes are the prettiest brown. She's the darling of my heart, sweetest little girl.
And I heard this voice, and I was drawn to it. I sat next to the record player. I played it over and over and over again. And I remember thinking, it sounds ancient, and yet he's sitting right here in this room with me. I was struck by it as something that sounded uniquely American. And I had this revelation. It truly was a revelation where I thought to myself, now I just don't know enough about America. I love this place, China. I'm obsessed, even obsessed with this place, China, but I don't know enough about my own country's roots and culture.
Shady Grove, I say. Shady Grove, my love, I'm about to go away.
I went out and I bought a banjo after that, and I sat there, and the first tune I learned was Shady Grove. I started learning about old-time music, and I literally thought it was just going to be that. It would be something I'd take along with me to China to remind me of home. So once I had taken the exams and I realized I was going to Beijing University for a master's in law, I decided that I wanted to go on a big road trip in America because I figured I'd be spending the rest of my life in some kind of cubicle and a working situation. So that's what I did. Stopped at the Augusta Heritage Center in West Virginia. They had incredible old fiddlers and people immersed in the tradition in West Virginia there teaching music. So I learned some banjo tunes and some songs there. And then I went to the IBMA, which is this International Bluegrass Music Association convention out of Louisville, Kentucky. There weren't many young women there, so I ran into a bunch of these young women in the hallway one night, and we saw each other, and we said, we've got to hang out. So we were like, okay, fifth floor, 11 p.m. And this was the last stop on my Farewell to the States tour, and a guy from a record label walked by and said, you guys should come down the hall and play for the president. And what do you know, the next week I was in Nashville cutting demos for a record label. I called my friends in Beijing and I said, hey guys, I'm not coming back. And they said, why? What's up? And I said, well, I got offered a record deal. And they said, you play music?
I got a mother. I got a father. Diamond waist and stark white collar. She looks good. He makes a dollar.
For some reason, Doc Watson's voice and the banjo led me to discover my own voice as a human, as an artist. It's like his sound took hold in my heart, and I carried it with me, and I could feel his voice coming through me, and I had a reason to sing suddenly. I'm really glad I'm not a lawyer living in Beijing, working at a cubicle every day.
Mama's at ease in social graces. Papa remembers the names with the faces. I can speak on the topic of religion. Just can't seem to make a clear
That was the musician Abigail Washburn talking about the late Doc Watson, who died a couple of weeks ago at age 89. Michael Rayfield produced our story. Have you had some life-changing experience from hearing a song or seeing a movie or reading a book or playing a video game? Write to us about it at studio360.org and we might put your aha moment on the air. And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. And do not forget about our Rebranding Canada project. We really do want to hear what you think. You can suggest a new slogan for Canada and find out what Canadians think of us. And you can see what our Canadian friends at the CBC's Q are plotting to rebrand America as well. No borders here. It's all at redesigningcanada.com. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Julia Barton,
Xicheng Lin,
Krista Ripple,
Mujahid Solomon,
Eve Asher,
Sarah Gook.
And thanks perpetually to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, I try to man up by heading to the rifle range.
It looks very casual, too, when you don't have your hand on the stock.
Why do you know so much about guns, like the stock? I had to like take a whole 10-hour course for all those.
I'm from Nebraska. I absorbed it.
It sounds manlier that you know all this stuff.
Adventures at the Gun Club with writer Joel Stein. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.